past president of the Liberty Association, which is a group of local people that promote the district. I'm a committee man. Right now I'm a committee man in my district. I was on the mayor's council for Plan B and at the stadium and all these things. I am the president of the Condominium Association, Imperial House Condominium Association. I am vice chairman of Brothers Brother, a humanitarian organization that ships all over the world, you know, especially to disaster areas that cost about itself. I don't know whether you're familiar with them, but they ship $85 million last year. And this is something that I really haven't been active for about a year or so, but suddenly I was vice chairman. And it's rather large, and it certainly helps me interface with my Cuban relief project. I'm chairman of the Center for Public Policy of the B'nai B'rith International, in charge of the Cuban Relief Project, which helping people in Cuba. I'm on the CRC board. I'm on the Holocaust Commission. I'm on the board of the Holocaust Commission presently.
I'm sure
a lot of activities.
You've been very active in the Jewish community, and in the and as you said, also in the community at large.
Right.
You mentioned the Cuban. Maybe we should start talking about the Cuban. I know this is something very close to you. Tell us how you got involved, why you got involved, and what you do and what has happened with it?
Well, I got involved. My love of Judaism and wanting to help Jews all over the world probably started, you know, with my JNF work, especially when I visited Refuseniks and I saw that these people had no chance. They were repressed. The religious, you know, the religion was repressed. They were not free to practice their religion. And here we were, with people that really, didn't care whether they were Jewish or not sometimes. And so I felt that everybody, that every Jew, no matter where they are, no matter how small it was, had a chance to visit, should have a chance to be Jewish. And so after visiting Refuseniks and helping that cause, I lulled for a while. That was in 1988. But in 1988, and I was arrested. I had taken some tapes that of conversations that people wanted me to take out to their family and so on. And I was arrested at that time. Well, I was detained on the border where they body searched me and found that I had these cassettes, and they listened to them. And they wanted me to sign a statement that said I was carrying anti-Soviet material. And, you know, it was a very frightening thing. It was like your whole life goes in front of you when something like that happens. And it really sent a jolt to me, and I said, you know, here we have all this freedom to do all these things, and here they are treating me like a spy because I had tapes of people that were being repressed. And, you know, it was at that time you had to kind of be very quiet about taking any supplies, religious supplies and otherwise. And so I became interested in that. But prior to that, I always had this interest in Cuba. And it was before the revolution, which is 1959, there was 15,000 Jews there. And then they all seemed to disappear. They left the country or whatever. In 1982, for sure, because I was interested, because I went to the University of Miami, I had been to Cuba in the 50s. Seen a lot of Jewish people. I was interested when in 82, that's when the Russians were there, Soviets, and found that there was, I couldn't find a presence of Jews. I never even knew what a Jew was. And I was very controlled, so I really didn't have much of an opportunity, so it kind of pushed it out of my mind, but I just wondered what happened to all of it. In 1996, I heard from somebody that there was a that there was a documentary called The Believers. It was a documentary on the Jewish Cuban community. There wasn't still a Jewish Cuban community. And so, being interested in having been to Cuba a couple of times, in 82 I went, because for a short time that you were allowed to go, and it was just very controlled. And so I got a copy of the tape, the documentary from the person that made it, and it showed that there was a Jewish community. There was a group called Jewish Solidarity, Cuban, who was helping them down there. There weren't too many people helping them, and nobody knew about it. When I came, there was nobody here in Pittsburgh that knew about the Jewish community. And so I was able to go with Jewish Solidarity with a license. You know, theoretically, you're not allowed to go. It's controlled. There's an embargo, and you need a license to go. Well, I was able to get a license with Jewish Solidarity and went down and found this wonderful Jewish community of about 1,600 people, and very much alive and struggling. They had no rabbis, and they were struggling to exist. The medicines were nil, practically. Food was in short supply. Everything was rationed. A person would make between $10 and $30, well, actually between $10 and $25 a month, which was no money. You know, it's, you know, people say, well, it's a lot of money for them. It's not a lot of money anywhere. And so I decided that it was doable for one person to be able to maybe put this whole thing together and do it, because there were 1,600 people. And so I started on my own, really, and I came back and I got some publicity from the Jewish Chronicle and started collecting supplies, scrounging from doctors and anybody I could get things from. You know, Food Gallery gave me powdered, you know, because the children over 7 weren't allowed to have milk. That includes older people that need, and they have a total lack of proteins and vitamins. And so I scrounged and got what I could, and then through publicity, and I convinced CNN to do a special on it. CNN didn't know there was a Jewish community. Nobody in Pittsburgh really knew there was a Jewish community. And so I just pushed and pushed and pushed to, with the help of a lot of others. You know, you've been in organization work, and you know well that you can't do anything alone. But one person can make a difference. And I was out to prove, not to prove it to myself or not to show anybody, but to prove that, you know, that that a person, if he's determined to do something, can make a difference in other people's lives. And so that's how I started with the Jewish Cuban. Then I was doing it kind of by myself, and then it started to get larger, and B'nai B'rith asked if they could join me because they thought that it was a good project, and it was good for me to join because I needed somebody behind me, you know, somebody some additional credibility, and plus additional publicity, and was able to, I couldn't accept donations, I couldn't give them a charitable deduction. I could do it through Jewish Solidarity, but I couldn't do it myself. So by joining up with B'nai B'rith, I was able to, anybody that gave dollars or checks or whatever, I was able to give them a tax deduction. And then the thing grew and grew, and then started to get donations from pharmaceutical companies and food. And we've shipped over probably in the last, since 1996, about, I would say, dollar-wise, over $2 million in supplies to them. We ship mammography machines. I arrange to have doctors go down there and interact with them and teach them how to use the mammography machines, and so on and so forth. So we've made, in the Jewish community, and the Jewish community has started to get stronger. JDC, of course, I've interacted with them. They have a person down there.
A joint distribution,
right?
Committee.
Yeah, joint distribution. They have a person down there. And I interact with everybody in the community. There's leaders of the community. There's president of each synagogue. There's president of the community. very similar to ours. They're the same problems, even though they have no money or no nothing. They still, still a Jewish community. And as a result, not only in my work, but certainly other people in other parts of the country, but we probably ship more out of here than anywhere. It's now a much more viable community. It's stronger because people go to services, and part of it is, of course, that they get some help. But they have three purposes in life. One is the family, their family. The second is their job, which isn't usually too important because they don't get too much of what they call la comunidad, the community, Jewish community. And so it gives their life not only a religious purpose, but a purpose in a country that's very sad, because these people, they have practically a no illiteracy rate there. And so these people are all either, especially in the Jewish community, doctors and engineers and professional people. So they know that they're living in a bad situation, the people that live there.
Where is the bulk of the people living?
Bulk of the people are living in Havana.
And you find the age groups, is there a difference in age groups there?
Well, there's a good overall, there's a lot of young people. And, there's, statistically, I'd say that it's averages out. A lot of young people are very interested in the synagogue and have taken part. On Friday night, younger people usually run the services.
And are they mostly Jews from, are they Sephardic, or are they Ashkenazic? Are they Jews that came from Europe, or the Jews that isn't rural?
Well, supposedly translator on Columbus's ship was Jewish. And at that time, some Jews came, but then it was a long time until then. And then a lot of people came at the turn of the century from Spain because of the prejudice. And the Sephardic, all the Sephardics came over because, and even at that time, in Columbus, it was the Inquisition, some of them came over. But they came over more into the early years. Most of them came because of wars, or because they just didn't come. They came because of wars. And then towards the 20s, a lot of them came from Europe because it was starting to get bad in Europe. And there was a law here that if they had a two-year residence there, they could get into the United States. And so, but that ended. So that's why a lot of them stayed. And they were in the dress build of business and manufacturing and so on and so on. They were the business people in Cuba, same as they did in other countries. And so before the revolution, actually during the Second World War, there was about 25,000, because a lot of them were parked there waiting for the war. And then it settled out to about, in the 50s, about 16,000, and that was during the revolution, there was 16,000, and 90% of the people left. Not only the United States, but to Mexico, to Venezuela, to other countries. They got out because a lot of people thought it was going to be like a Holocaust. But what it was really is that Castro was taking over all the businesses and squeezing them out of their own houses. And it was similar, but not. But they were afraid, especially after a lot of them had a history of the Holocaust and other things, and they thought they ought to get out of there. And that was the reason why a lot of them got out, because they had gone through this once, and they didn't want to go through it again.
And you said there were about 16,000 left in Cuba.
No, there's 1,600, about 1,500 to 1,600 now.
Now in Cuba.
But there were 16,000 prior to the revolution.
So it's really a relatively small community.
It's a relatively small community, but it's like so many other Jewish communities throughout the world. It's small. They look large. They're active. That's 1,600 active. I mean, there's some that probably aren't active. And there are different cities that are, as I say, the biggest part of the community is Havana, probably 1,200 in Havana.
And you've taken people down with you.
They are missions.
Missions. And how do you get these people? I mean, how do you, how are they permitted to go? Because
I have a license.
Oh, you have a
that I can take them. Mm-hmm. And so they go with my license. And I set up with, sometimes I work hand in hand with Jewish Solidarity or Havana Tour, and so we set up through Cuba. You can do that. I mean, it's not illegal on their part. It's only illegal on our part. And by taking them, I can take them. They're legal.
Can you fly directly to Cuba from the States or
Miami,
from Miami?
Actually, there's a flight from New York, but it's really handier for me to go from Miami. Now, they're rebuilding the synagogue. They're doing a lot of rebuilding as far as the religious places. The synagogue in Havana is being rebuilt. It was disrepair. There were birds nesting on the bema. Broken windows and all this kind of stuff. So now they're, through... The main thing is making people aware. I mean, it's, if I prove nothing else, if you can get people to be aware of a situation, especially Jews about Jews, it becomes relatively easy to get help to them. And by my partnering with Brother's Brother, who I'm now chairman with, they will give me any supplies I need. They have supplies. And they gave me $250,000 one-a-day vitamin pills. That I, $250,000 sounds like a lot. But if every one of those Cubans took one pill a day, 250,000 pills would only last about 8 months. So they're in need of everything. So what seems like, so you only have 1,500 people. So 1,500 people that don't have anything. So if you spread vitamin pills and you have 250,000, it doesn't last as long. It seems like it lasts for 10 years. It doesn't last for 10 years.
So this is the bulk of the kind of things you send, medicine and foods, certain foods, and do you send clothing?
I just sent down, somebody donated 600 pounds of clothing, ladies' clothing, 120 pairs of shoes, 500 dresses.
These local people from all over?
No, people call me from all over the country. All calls from Israel, and they wanted to help. Because basically, I probably, know as much as anybody about the Jewish community in Cuba. So I know how to do it, how to get things done, who to talk to. I work with the Office of Religious Affairs in Cuba, the Cuban Office of Religious Affairs with the Castro government. They're very cooperative with us. They seem to like the Jewish community. Castro has been to the Hanukkah party. They have a council of churches of which the Jewish community is part of. Interesting story. It's a very interesting story, which hadn't been publicized, is when the Pope came, Fidel allowed Christmas to be a holiday, but he didn't make it forever, just for that year. It was 1997, and so he made it legal for that year. So in 1998, he had called a meeting of the Office of Religious, or the Council of Churches, and he said, they were discussing. The meeting started, it was on November 19th, it started at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and they had dinner at 12 o'clock, and that's the way he works, he doesn't have hours, and then it was over at 2 o'clock in the morning. One of the questions he asked Dr. Miller, who's president of the Jewish community, and there were three Jewish people, Della Duarte, Dr. Miller, who's president, Della, who's vice president, and someone from the Sephardic synagogue and someone from the Orthodox synagogue. And he said, Dr. Miller, what do you think about Christmas being legal? Dr. Miller thought for a second. He said, how could I be upset about celebrating the birthday of a Jew. Castro laughed, and he laughed, and he said, I never thought about it that way. And whatever the reason is, they did make it a legal holiday.
Well, do you speak Spanish?
I speak some Spanish, not as much as I should, but I speak Spanish, and I understand Spanish.
And they, is there anybody, do they speak any English there?
Oh, yeah. Most of them, most of the people that are active, you know, speak English. Not everybody, but everybody that, most of the people that I do most of my talking.
When I first got here, I heard you planning. Are you planning some kind of an event now for the Spanish community, for the Cuban community?
Because of my plan on awareness, I thought that it would be a good idea to bring Cuba to Pittsburgh. And so I spoke to the Jewish Community Center about, came to my attention that there was a art exhibit that was available to me called Cultural Bridges, which is a student art exhibit from Cuba. And I started out with that, and then it kind of grew, and then we're taking over both buildings of the Jewish Community Center, and a photographic exhibit, this art exhibit, this Cultural Bridges exhibit, and also artifacts. Let's see whether we're shooting. We're teaching salsa lessons. There's movies on the Jewish community, speaking on the Jewish community. There's a show on the 15th of April.
And it's all for the, it's to be, make citizens aware, the Pittsburghers are aware.
People aware of Cuba and the Jewish community in Cuba. Of course, the windfall is, it wasn't a windfall, but this alien thing where the boy came over with his mother has brought a lot of attention to Cuba. And the big problem that the Cubans have is the fact that that these Cubans from South Florida, you know, that came over, mm-hmm. and there's 600,000 Cubans, do not want anything to happen in Cuba. They just want Castro out of there. And so they don't like anything to happen as far as Cuba, or anything to be sent there. If I was doing what I'm doing here in Miami, they could bomb my store. My life could be in danger, because they just don't want anybody to do that. Here it isn't the same.
Have you received any kind of awards throughout your adult career for any of the activities that you've had
Well, first of all, there's one award that I should tell you about that I created, and that's the JNF Guardian of Israel. And that was an award that I created because of my feelings for Ernest Nachman. And Ernest, I used to say to Ernest that when I grew up, I want to be just like you. Ernest came over, he was on the boat before the St. Louis. He didn't drive. He was active at 80 years old in 15 organizations. There was no one I've ever seen like him. And I never thought Ernest was honored enough. He was on the board of JNF, and I created this award called the Guardian of Israel Award in his honor. We did a logo, we designed a logo for it, and it was a special award that was created. It was called the Guardian of Israel, it wasn't called the Ernest Nachman Award. And since then, there's been eight recipients, and they're Susan Gutman is going to be the recipient. It's one of the major awards that JNF gives here. It's interesting, and I created it in a very interesting way was the people that have gotten the award in the past pick the next recipient. It is not done by the officers of JNF. It's done by the past recipient. So when they select somebody, they want somebody that they can really be proud of. It's not done by money or status or anything else. It's done strictly by Joel Reitman, who got the award, Arnie Wagner, Rabbi Torsky. He doesn't take awards, but he took that one. So that's the first requisite. It doesn't have to be given every year. can't find somebody we want to give, we don't do it. It's not like an annual dinner. And we have our, as I say, we have our own, the logo is, which I designed, was two hands holding the Star of David, and then around the hands are two trees. And it's neat. We've had as many as 200 to 300 people. The other thing that I did is it's not a dinner, it's a reception, because I want to keep the price down. The price this year has gone up a little bit, but it's $20 to come, so that anybody can come. And if someone can't afford to come, we'll see that they get there. And that was because of Ernest Hoffman, that this board was not created for people that, you know, can afford to spend $200 a piece to come to an event. It's for everybody. So that was one award that I created that I'm very, very proud of. And I created a fund at the Pittsburgh Foundation that will be funded into perpetuity. I received the Man of the Year award from J&F, who's honored at the dinner. I've gotten several awards from the Tree of Life. I got the Humanitarian Award from the B'nai B'rith. I've gotten an award from Israel Bond Man of the Year Award. What else?
And is there anything else that you'd like to tell us?
Well, I think that, you know, that what I've told you, I'll just repeat, that I think that if anybody listens to this or reads this in future years, that I think it's so important that you start the education of children, knowing that and understanding that people can make a difference. It's people give to people, and they don't always give to causes. And so I think that if you set an example and you know, in other words, you don't depend on other people to do what you should be doing, that you can make a difference in life. And you certainly, in the Jewish community and charity, that we can make a difference. Every Jew is important in the community. And the rest of my life, I think, will be devoted to saying that whatever needs to be happened within the framework of what I can do, physically, mentally, and financially, I will do. And I think that I have proven that.
I think you've done a wonderful yeoman job with what you are doing, and I'm very proud to be honored by interviewing you.
Thank you. I would say that there's poor Jewish people all over the world, including the United States. But the difference between them and Cuba and everywhere else is, if you go to countries like Costa Rica, Venezuela, Argentina, I'm saying South, and even in Russia, that they have generally an opportunity to be what they want to be. If they're a doctor, they can be a successful doctor. There's people throughout the world, Jews throughout the world, making, you know, and have a lot of money, a lot of status through their hard work. But in Cuba, no matter how hard you work, you could be a doctor with an extra degree as a specialist in research, and you could be a Jonas Salk, and you would make a maximum of $30 a month. And so even though they may be brilliant, they may have all of these things going for them, they don't have the opportunities that Jews have in other parts of the world. As I say, there's Jews, poor Jews everywhere, but sometimes it's because of their individual circumstance or their education or whatever, just like here. But there, they really have no opportunity to be anything more than what they are. A doctor can only hope, because they get paid in pesos, and that can't buy much. To buy anything in Cuba, you have to have dollars. And so the greatest hope of a doctor would be to be able to be a cab driver, because he would have access to dollars and tourists. So, which is a rather sad note. No matter how good of a doctor, no matter how good of an engineer, They would only hope to be a beach boy or something that was, you know, beneath what they were capable of doing because they could make more money that way. And so that's, to me, that's a major difference in Jews throughout the world. As you go almost anywhere, you're going to find a popular, like Mexico City is, Mexico is a perfect example, but a very successful Jewish population in Mexico. Yeah, not saying that there's not some poor ones, but sometimes it's because of themselves rather than. But you do not have that opportunity in Cuba. You do not have the opportunity. And so, do I think that they were among the poorest Jews in the world? Yes, but on the other hand, I think they're among the happiest Jews in the world because they are allowed to. There's no prejudice there because everybody's the same. I mean, that's one thing about communism or socialism. Is that, you know, there doesn't have to be a lot of jealousy. So everybody's kind of the same, and they're happy within their community. And like, yes, would they like to have more and be better off? That's true, but they do the best they can with what they have. It's a lesson to be learned. It's really a lesson to be learned from everybody. And I learned a lesson, but I'm very thankful for what I have as a result. And thankful within the framework of what I have and what I'm